Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, this is Lily Gorin with the New Books Network, the New Books in Political Science podcast. Today, I'm joined by Hernan Flom, the author of The Informal Regulation of Criminal Markets in Latin America. This book was published in 2022 by Cambridge University Press, and it is a deep dive into the complexity of state institutions, particularly the police, and essentially criminal markets, particularly drug markets in Latin America, and how they work together and in opposition to one another. But I'm going to let Hernan tell us all about that. I'd like to welcome Hernan Flom to the podcast and ask him to tell us a little bit about himself and how you came to this particular project.
Well, first of all, hi, Lily. Thank you very much for having me. It's great to be here. So how I came to this project, and it's a bit of a long answer because it's been a long time coming. So as most first books, it grew out of my dissertation at UC Berkeley. But before that, I had been working quite a bit on policing and criminal justice in Latin America, both in academic capacity and also as a consultant in various research projects. And so I came into the doctoral study with a very clear notion of what I wanted to research. So it was a matter of like finding the right question or the right way to frame it into something that has already been looked at quite a bit. That is, you know, the issue of drug trafficking and drug-related violence and its relation to the state. So after a little bit of thinking and you know, pondering what would be like the best questions or the best cases, I thought, well, maybe it would be interesting to try to think of drug trafficking as you would any other type of market, just that it is an illegal one, but it has a very strong connection with legal institutions or formal institutions, and particularly the one that is supposed to enforce the law, which is the police. And so I was curious to see how this varied across Latin America, and particularly in metropolitan areas, in the sense of how were police dealing with these various drug markets in terms of how much were they using some of the main instruments that they had with regard to these markets, particularly force or violence and corruption mainly. How were they applying this? Was it in a coordinated way or in an uncoordinated way? And what role were the politicians having in this matter as well? And then see what came out of this relationship. And I started noticing different patterns in some of the cases that I was a bit familiar with in Argentina, where I'm from, and Brazil, which seemed to be a good comparison, also being in the Southern Cone and having like a similar structure and role in terms of the drug markets, international economy, so to speak. So it started from there. So then I started looking into these cases a little bit more deeply, started working on the dissertation, which I completed, you know, a half a life ago. And yeah, and then, well, the whole book revision and writing process started, but basically it maintained the same notion from that point on, even though there was a little of steps along the way as to getting it published, as you know is the case usually for most authors.
And one of the things that you sort of talk about in the book, and you make it this very sort of clear in terms of the research, is that the police are distinct within the society. They are connected to the politicians, but they're distinct from the politicians. And that the police operate in slightly different ways in different areas. But you also talk about how the police as a political institution operates in relationship to the drug cartels, the sort of organized markets, as you said, that are illegal, but are structured. So we're talking about different kinds of structures in relation to one another's. Can you talk a little bit about how you sort of started to tease that out?
Yeah. So basically what I started to see is that, as you mentioned, there were various patterns with regard to the relationship between politicians and police. So first, as you said, these are distinct entities. So this is something that I started, I think that my book kind of differentiates itself from some of the literature on this topic, which tends to sort of think of the state as a single actor, a singular actor in its fight against or in its complicity with the drug cartels or other organized criminal actors. And I, from the beginning, wanted to split it and say, well, you know, on the one hand, you have the politicians whose interests may not be the same as those of the police. And the police itself might, even though they are formally subordinate to these politicians, they might not necessarily be abiding by everything that the politicians tell them to do. So I think that is something that has to be looked at instead of assumed. And so I started digging up on that and saw that there were various, like I said, patterns or different types of relationships between police and politicians that hinged on the level and type of police autonomy. So in some cases, police have a greater autonomy from politicians in the sense that politicians do not have a strong role in supervising or intervening in various aspects of the police internal governance and how they carry out their operations. And in other cases, it's the opposite. And when the opposite happens, when politicians can curtail police autonomy, they can also do that for different purposes, whether it is to, as I say in the book, professionalize the police, like make it more respectful of the rule of law and human rights and the general norms of democracy. And in other cases, it might be to politicize it, to make it more subservient to their own personal or partisan interests. So depending on these type of patterns, what I argue is that you will get different types of connections, or as I refer to it in the book, informal regulatory arrangements in which the police intervene in drug markets differently. So, for instance, when the police have greater autonomy from politicians, the type of regulatory structure that emerges is what I refer to as a particularistic confrontation, which is quite disorganized. You know, police are not a cohesive unit, even with respect to each other, much less to the politicians. So this results in a very high level of corruption, very fragmented deals that the police have going on with criminal actors, and in some cases even higher levels of violence, not only between police and criminal actors, but also between, you know, in terms of police violence and criminal violence itself. So that is like one distinct pattern, and then there are other patterns that emerge when police autonomy is lower, when politicians are able to subordinate it a little bit, either to their own interests or to more general aspects of the rule of law.
And one of the things that you note at the very start of the book that is that you actually worked in Argentina and you interacted directly for an extended period of time with a lot of folks who were involved in the police and politicians. You were in the Ministry of Defense, is that correct? Security. And so you talk about many people throughout the book that you spoke with and you had many, many interviews. And I was curious about how this also contributed to the sort of broader thesis that you were working on in terms of, you know, somebody saying something to you and you're like, ah, that proves my thesis. And somebody saying something else to you and you're like, maybe doesn't prove my thesis. Can you talk about your experience with these interactions, these actual interactions?
Yeah, of course. So I mean, I would maybe split it into two parts. So like one, there was a set of interactions that went on with the police and with other actors as well, obviously politicians, but also judges, prosecutors, etc. When I was carrying out the field work for the dissertation and then for the book. But then, as you mentioned, once I completed the PhD and a postdoc, I went back to Argentina and I worked for a couple of years in the National Ministry of Security. And I was in charge of a training program for higher ranking police officers. But just in that capacity, you know, I got to interact a lot with police who were not necessarily like the central actors of my study, because I was looking at more subnational police forces in the book, and these are federal forces, but they still had some type of relevance of participation. But in that, what I took out of those interactions maybe was that for the most part, I sort of gained more confidence in that one aspect of my thesis was correct, in the sense of I talk about the importance that political competition has in terms of elected officials' capacity to control the police, to reduce their autonomy. And I say that, well, when there is a high level of competition, such as, for instance, a change in government or a high level of fragmentation in terms of divided government or a split cabinet and whatnot, that would make politicians' chances to control the police much harder. They will reduce those chances, I mean. So I think that really started seeing that, and I saw that those kinds of reflections from the politicians that I was working with. So I was in an administration that had a little bit of a fluctuation in terms of its electoral output during just those 2 years. So when I came into the government, just a couple of months later, there was a midterm election, which the government won. And so they felt very bolstered and confident. Well, this is the time when we can, you know, sort of start demanding and imposing different things from the police. And then just a couple of years later, when it came to the next general election, the government's popularity had, you know, crashed down. You know, the country was in the middle of an economic crisis, as it usually is, sadly. And then the government lost the sort of primary election before the general election. And at the time, it was like basically the sense around the administration and in terms around the ministry was, well, this is basically over. So like, there's no point in trying to start anything now, because like, nobody's going to listen to us. They're not going to follow anything. They're just going to like make pretend and maybe even just say straight to our faces, like, what are you talking about? You're going to be out of here within a couple of months. So, yeah, I mean, I certainly saw that kind of dynamic. What I think maybe, that doesn't necessarily contradict my argument, but it certainly would nuance it. And this is something that I'm starting to look at for different projects is, well, to what level, again, do we also think of the police as a singular organization, right? So it's not just a split between politicians and police, but within the police, there are also various cultures or subcultures that emerge, and you know, there are people who sort of take a more isolationist approach and, you know, think of for themselves and try to steer away from what the hierarchy wants. There are also various limitations on to what extent police commanders can impose certain orders on their subordinates. You know, there are certain groups within the police, certain cliques that, you know, depending on their role, on their function, they have maybe their own way of doing things, and hence their own internal sources of legitimacy, maybe because of certain types of expertise or prestige within the organization and whatnot. So it is very much of a complex world, which I'm still very much looking into. But yeah, I think that would probably be the main aspect that I took that, like I said, doesn't necessarily contradict the argument, but it does put a little bit more nuance to it or complexifies it a little bit.
And it's certainly something we in the United States have been, you know, examining and seeing in our own police forces in different parts of the country and different size areas. And
Yeah, well, the U.S. has about 19,000 police forces, you know, counting all police departments, county sheriffs, you know, federal agencies, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, it's like a bit of a never-ending story.
And so I wanted to ask you again, because I am not at all an expert in any of this, about the two countries themselves. And obviously, you know, you have great familiarity with Argentina, but Brazil is, you know, a very large country, different language, different culture, different colonial settlers. And so I was curious to know a bit about how you set up this comparison, and what are some of the distinctions you found between Argentina and Brazil as Latin American compatriots?
So I think that I was interested in this comparison first because I, you know, also wanted to kind of get away from the typical cases of the drug organized criminal actors literature, which are typically, as you probably are thinking about right now, Mexico and Colombia. Brazil, to some extent, was already being discussed, particularly the case of Rio de Janeiro, but not as much so the case of Sao Paulo, as I include in the book, and not as much from a comparative perspective. So looking at these two different stories. So the way I thought about it, and I think it came out, or I tried at least, I think it came out nicely in the book, it's that you have this kind of cross comparison that goes on the one hand, between each case in the same country, so between Rio de Janeiro and Sao Paulo in Brazil, and then in Argentina between Buenos Aires and Rosario. But then you have also similarities in the patterns across these countries. So to some extent, Buenos Aires is more similar to Sao Paulo in the sense that the government there was able to subordinate the police, albeit for a different purpose, and then established a more ordered or coordinated regulatory arrangement with lower levels of violence, both from the police and from criminal violence in general. Whereas Rosario is much closer to Rio in a sense that it's been, particularly for the last almost two decades now, a very difficult situation with a lot of political turmoil and competition, with a very highly autonomous and disorganized police. And this has resulted in abysmal levels of corruption and an ever-increasing level of violence, which is very similar to the story in Rio de Janeiro, except maybe for the part that police violence in Rosario is much lower than it is in Rio. I mean, the level of police violence that you see in Rio de Janeiro is atrocious. It's probably, I mean, if not the highest, among the highest, certainly in the world. And that is not something that is replicated in the other context. That might certainly have something to do with some of the factors that you mentioned in your question, in terms of the differences in terms of colonial origins. Obviously, there's a very big gap in terms of the racial configuration between two countries. And there's, as in the US, in Brazil, there is a very significant concentration of victims of police violence among Afro Brazilians, who are also generally poor and live in favelas and are most typically associated with crime. And these racial dynamics are not equivalent in Argentina. I mean, there's also obviously racism and other types of profiling, but they have a different type of tone, I would think. But going back to their similarities, I think that one of the things that was interesting about them was, A, that these were two countries that had historically been ports of exit of drugs from Latin America to Europe, as opposed to a different corridor that, you know, goes from Colombia through Mexico or Central America and sometimes through the Caribbean to the United States. So this is another route. And secondly, they have been adding to this historic export role an increasing level of internal consumption, particularly in their main cities, which are the ones that I'm looking at. So I'm concentrated on the main metropolitan areas. And another aspect that I think was important in picking these cases is that they are middle-income countries with relatively high state capacity. And that is important because I want to show that this is not a matter of state capacity in the sense that, you know, these drug markets are burgeoning because there is no state, there are no police, the state is unable to do anything about it, doesn't have the resources. Of course, there are, you know, issues with resources and the police, as in all parts of the state, but that is not necessarily the problem, particularly when you're looking at an area of the drug trafficking trade, its economy, that is very much anchored territorially. You know, it's one thing to look at the contraband that takes place across international borders, you know, where drugs are concealed, sometimes in a very elaborate or sophisticated ways, or let alone when, you know, drugs are shipped overseas, you know, hidden in containers of various types of products, and there's a much greater level of sophistication and less that what of what the state can do about it, in a sense, to control that. But here you have, drugs that are being sold sometimes in open sight from neighborhoods across the city in, like, again, the most populated cities in the world, and then maybe like right across or a couple of blocks away from police stations, or where police are circulating and making the rounds on a daily or hourly basis. So there has to be something else going on there that explains, okay, well, why and how are police intervening in this area, in this context, in this way, and not so in, or they're doing so differently in another. And I think that Brazil and Argentina were interesting cases to highlight that. And finally, and not to dwell too much on this question, to, you know, just make this a methodological or research design talk, there is something that is particular to them that other countries in Latin America don't have, that is, they are federal countries. And that means that the main police force that is in charge of patrolling and controlling different types of criminal activity on the ground are the subnational police, and they are beholden to the governors. And so this allows for us to see, you know, very clear subnational variation across the cases without necessarily tracing it back to the federal government or the national government, as you would have to do in other cases in Latin America.
And excuse me, one of the things that you did find that I was really intrigued by was the sort of contracts, I guess, that happened in a number of places between the police and some of the criminal markets. And I was I mean, I understand there's oftentimes been these relationships of, you know, corrupt police having relationships with the drug cartels or the mafia, and it's sort of protection. But you note in the book, and you explore this, and I found it fascinating, about how in places where some of these contracts existed, the violence went down substantially. And you know, again, it was kind of like a form of governance, but not the actual legal governance. Can you talk about one or two of those examples?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I certainly think that's on the ground, it's like a very fascinating thing to uncover. I mean, and you sort of hear about it or either from the media or reading about it in different existing accounts of these cases. But then it's, you know, like another level of excitement to see that kind of like manifesting itself for you as a researcher. I think that the two main kind of informal contracts that you might be alluding to refer to the two ordered cases in the book, or the most orderly cases, I should say, and those are Buenos Aires and Sao Paulo. So in the Buenos Aires case, and again, I should emphasize, these are obviously informal dealings, agreements, pacts. There's obviously nothing written here, but what is going on is like a very evident type of exchange of protection from the police towards criminal actors in exchange for a tax or some type of material benefit or some other non-material incentives sometimes. And in exchange for that, what the police can do is basically sometimes alert criminals as to, you know, if there's another gang that is trying to raid their area, maybe the police can even arrest those criminals. If then the criminals can also, you know, point them towards a drug shipment or even give them a share of the drugs that they themselves are importing, so the police can keep up the pretense of, yes, we are fighting the drug war, we are seizing these many drugs, and so on and so forth, and save face, and particularly this is something that looks good for the politicians. And in the meantime, there is a lot of money, in many cases, that is being funneled into sometimes the pockets of individual police officers. Sometimes it goes towards, you know, funding the police's informal budget, so to speak. So police working conditions are not the best in Latin America, as you might imagine. So sometimes this is helpful, you know, either to, you know, put an extra load of gas in the vehicles, or to be able to repair, you know, a station where pipes are leaking, and so on. And sometimes it's just seized by individual officers or politicians that, again, they can also put this to use for their own political benefit in terms of financing electoral campaigns, or for enriching themselves, so to speak. And there is no shortage of illegal or sort of in non-declared, non-disclosed funds that are being circulated in Argentine politics and in Latin American politics, probably more generally. The other case, to wrap up this case, I mean, what also comes out of this agreement is a non-aggression pact, so to speak, in the sense that what police are demanding from the criminals is that, okay, you're able to carry out this enterprise, you know, the drug selling and whatnot, but you have to keep a lid on criminal violence in this territory. Otherwise, you know, the police would be under greater political and social pressure to crack down on those criminals. And so this has a somewhat pacifying effect in the sense that police don't need to raid these different areas. There doesn't need to be so many violent exchanges between the police and criminal actors. And also criminal actors are not fighting each other because the police are kind of warding them off. So that reduces the level of violence overall. The other case where this happens is in Sao Paulo, and that is a different configuration because, A, you have, as opposed to Buenos Aires, where the drug market scene is much more fragmented, in Sao Paulo it's much more consolidated, so you have a drug gang there that is hegemonic, that's been controlling drug trafficking and many other illegal markets for a couple of decades now, the so-called PCC, or First Comando da Capital, Primeiro Comando da Capital in Portuguese. And the second difference is that, unlike in Buenos Aires, where there has been a very high level of corruption and appropriation of rents from illegal enterprises, including drug trafficking, by police and politicians, this doesn't seem to be the case in Sao Paulo, at least not what I could gather from my research there. What does seem to be going on is that for most of this period, there has been also a non-aggression pact between the police and the criminal gang, where the police afford the gang certain privileges to operate, both in the prison and in the streets, mainly in the urban periphery of Sao Paulo. And the gang also then limits its own assaults on police and also keeps a lid on other criminal activity that is going on in the neighborhood. This obviously in the service of having a more stable business environment, so to speak, in which to conduct drug selling and being able to fund the gang's structure and support its network, because obviously it has a lot of financial needs, particularly when you have a high level of members who are imprisoned. So that is kind of what's going on. And both of these cases have, for the most part, in the last two decades, been able to keep a lid on violence, both in police violence and criminal violence in general, to a much more successful level degree than what the other cases have done, that is Rio de Janeiro and Rosario.
And you talked a little bit about Rio and Rosario already, but can you talk about the structural distinctions, since you've given us this really clear cases with regard to the orderly function of the markets and the interactions in Buenos Aires and Sao Paulo, the flip side of what's not going on in the other two places?
Yes. So probably, like I said, Rio is maybe a little bit more familiar for most scholars or observers of Latin America, just because the level of police violence that you see there is so egregious. And even though now it's probably worse than it has been, it has been kind of fluctuating for a few decades, but it's always been on a very high level. And that, I argue, is in part because every time that politicians have come into office in Rio with the pretense of, well, we want to reform the police, we want to make the police more respectful of human rights, we want to curb police violence and abuses, particularly against the poor, they've never had, or very rarely have had, I should say, the political clout to do it. And so what tends to happen is that, you know, these reforms are very short-lived. They are undermined by resistance from both the police and other political and social actors. And basically, they just like kind of fade away towards the end of the term. And then, you know, a different administration comes in with a different type of perspective on security that says, well, you know, the other previous administration was too lenient on crime and did not use the police enough. We need to give more powers back to the police. So you get this kind of cycle of reform and counter-reform that is very present in Rio and also to some extent in Rosario as well. You see the same cycles of different elected officials trying to apply different types of policies with regard to the police. What comes out in both of these situations is a very uncoordinated structure within the police and consequently an uncoordinated regulation by the police of drug markets. So instead of having like a more vertically organized or hierarchical structure of controlling these drug markets, as you have in the other cases. Every unit of police, every precinct or division or territorial location or outpost and whatnot is basically trying to fend off for themselves or trying to maximize the amount of rents that they can extract from this business. And they are not offering any type of credible or reliable protection to the drug market actors that are carrying out this activity. So what you get there is that, on the one hand, police in Rio particularly distinguishing themselves by using force and violence as a way of pressuring criminal actors into increasing the amount of funding that they are supposed to pay the police, even if the protection is not reliable. So that makes for a great deal of confrontation between the police and the criminals. In Rosario, by contrast, the criminals are not as powerful and not as organized as they are in Rio, so the police have an easier time in sometimes extracting these rents from the criminal actors. But they also but they are similar in the sense that they are also not offering any type of credible protection from different police units, from different police forces, or from judicial prosecution. So this generates a lot of instability and uncertainty in this area. So you see a great deal of conflict between criminal gangs. Many times that civilians are involved in the crossfire, and this generates a great level of civilian casualties as a result of these drug markets. And I think that Rio is simply a more extreme version of this of the scenario, in the sense that, as I said before, police are much more inclined to use violence there because they are also dealing with more sophisticated criminal actors that are more heavily armed than is the case in Rosario. But sadly, what has been going on in Rosario over the last 2 years is that general levels of violence have increased to the point that they are very similar to what is going on in Rio. So there are some similarities as well.
And so in terms of these comparisons and the understanding of them in context of federal states, which is I thought also a unique aspect of your work here. Is there something about the federal states? I mean, I assume it's the sort of power that goes down to the subnational areas that allows for more or less coordination with criminal gangs?
I don't think that there's something about the federal states in particular. I mean, it has to do more so with maybe the political alignments between the federal and the subnational government. So for instance, maybe to try to illustrate this a little bit, in Argentina, there is a much greater level of participation or interventions, should say, of the federal government in the case of the province of Buenos Aires, because it is the largest and most important province in the country. I mean, it holds about 40% of the electorate. And for most of the time, there was also the president and the governor of the province came from the same party. So what happened in the province politically also has obviously a great level of importance for presidential aspirations, for election or re-election. And by the same token, federal decisions in terms of, say, how do they distribute resources from the federal government to the subnational governments have a great deal of importance for the province of Buenos Aires as well. So in this sense, the police has been one of the areas in which this struggle or conflict between the federal and the subnational government has occurred. But that goes back to whether you had a political rivalry or by opposition and alignment between these two actors. So when these actors are in tandem, when say the head of the federal government, the president, is the undisputed leader of the national movement, then there is maybe a tense harmony, but a harmony at last of these two actors. In Brazil, maybe there is not that much of a direct, or at least I didn't see as much of a direct influence of the federal government on the subnational governments. The only exception might be the case of Rio during the time when the program that was referred to as pacification police was in vogue, because basically what happened is that the state and local corps, or the bodies of the legislative blocs at the local and state level of the PT, the Workers Party, which was in power at the national government at the time, the national party was aligned with the party that was governing Rio, which was the PMDB. So their blocs in the state legislature and in the city legislature basically like gave their blessing for this program to take place, and then tried to challenge it, as maybe some other members of the left had in previous administrations. So that enabled the program to be implemented. But other than that, the role of the federal government, I think, when yes, sometimes they send federal troops, obviously that is important, but aside from that, it's much more reduced. And so I don't think that there is anything maybe specific about the federal government, but that being said, I think that what's important to point out, I think this is something that was relevant for my argument, is that on the one hand, these you know, that the crimes that are being investigated here that are related to drug trafficking, they tend to be a formal prerogative of the federal government because they are, you know, more complex, more relevant, etc. But either because that jurisdiction has been formally handed down to the subnational governments, or because simply, you know, the subnational police are the main body of the state in the streets, and they are running into these situations and these markets more often, the subnational police are in fact like sort of the de facto regulators of these drug markets and other illegal markets. So I think that is an important contrast between, okay, what does the law say about, you know, who is supposed to regulate this criminal activity, and then who is informally and de facto regulating this. Just to maybe add something that I also should have mentioned regarding this point, this conflict was also apparent in Rosario at one point that I was studying the case, because on the one hand, the subnational administration was very much alarmed and worried about the level of violence that was coming out of the confrontation between criminal gangs and how that it was spreading around the city. But on the other hand, they say, well, we don't have the judicial authorization to do anything about drug trafficking with our own police, because that is a prerogative of the federal government. And the federal government is either, you know, they have very few or scant manpower or little political interest sometimes to intervene in the city. So that allowed the problem to fester and reach a point where it was very complicated for the subnational government to deal with.
And you already alluded to where your research may be going. But one of the questions I always ask my authors when I talk to them is, what exactly are you working on next?
Yep. Okay. So I'm working on a couple of things. So the main thing that I'm interested in is variation in levels of police violence. And this, what I'm basically trying to look at is, okay, how similarly to what I've been researching previously about how does the role or the relationship between police and politicians influence this outcome. But also, as I alluded to in one of your previous questions, maybe how does the internal organization of police also affect this outcome? And by that I mean, what are the key variables that are occurring inside the police, particularly in those spaces that are the most frequently interacting with citizens and potentially most involved in situations of violence and abuse of human rights? What are the main factors that are conditioning these officers' behaviors, right? Is it, you know, where they are located? Is it what type of messages are they getting from their peers, from their superiors? How are they interpreting signals from political actors? So one of the, I should say, maybe one of the pending assignments, I think, from my book is maybe trying to theorize and specify a little bit more, kind of like the mechanism chain that goes from political decisions, from public policy decisions, to the actions of an individual police officer on the ground. So I think that kind of micro logic as to how police operate still needs to be a little bit more fleshed out. And then seeing, okay, well, how is it that we get these different patterns? I mean, so why is it, you know, that, you know, if every police officer is acting by themselves, so to speak, why do we get like a more general pattern from the police department in the city or in the province in general? So that is kind of like what I'm interested in looking at. And I have a couple of projects related to that, but yeah, maybe that's as far as I could talk about it right now. But I mean, I'd be happy to talk more about it, but I don't want to.
Will you be looking at Brazil and Argentina again, or just one of them, or other countries?
Yeah, so probably I would be looking at Brazil and Argentina just because I already have like accumulated a lot of experience on them, and they seem to be relevant cases for this question. But my interest and where I'm going to be carrying out my field work, hopefully within the next few months over the course of the year, is also going to be incorporating the case of Cali in Colombia, which is like a totally different story with regard to Brazil and Argentina. I mean, starting with the fact that it is a different organization of police in a unitary country, a national police force. But one in which is still, I think at least, you still see this level of variation in terms of police violence and police behavior at the subnational level and with every change or with changes in the political control of the municipal government in this case. So I'm interested in seeing how does that play out. And then potentially I could add a couple of other cases, but for now, that is where I'm going to be starting the research.
Well, I hope when the book is done, you'll come and speak with me about it on the New Books Network.
I hope it won't be too long before that stop, but yeah.
I hope it won't be as long, perhaps, as the gestation of this book.
Yeah. I mean, hopefully that won't be the case, but yeah, you never know how these projects evolve. Yeah.
I want to thank Hernán Flom for joining me today to talk about the informal regulation of criminal markets in Latin America, published by Cambridge University Press in 2022. I direct people to the Cambridge University Press website for purchase of the book. Do you have a brick and mortar store that you want to give a shout out to?
No, not that I know of. So,
okay.
So yeah, I will just leave it. It's available at your usual retailers or usual distributors.
Thank you so much for joining me today, Hernán.
No, thank you so much for having me, Lily.